This is disc number 7.
What? Bury it again and leave them to come and see the ground disturbed? Not exactly. Not exactly. We'll take it to my den. Why, of course. Might have thought of that before. You mean, number 1? No. Number 2, under the cross. The other place is bad. Too common. All right. It's nearly dark enough to start. Injun Joe got up and went about from window to window, cautiously peeping out. Presently, he said, "Who could have brought those tools here? Do you reckon they can be upstairs?" The boy's breath forsook them. Injun Joe put his hand on his knife, halted a moment, undecided, and then turned toward the stairway. The boys thought of the closet, but their strength was gone. The steps came creaking up the stairs. The intolerable distress of the situation woke the stricken resolution of the lads. They were about to spring for the closet when there was a crash of rotten timbers and Injun Joe landed on the ground amid the debris of the ruined stairway. He gathered himself up, cursing, and his comrade said, "Now what's the use of all that? If it's anybody and they're up there, let them stay there. Who cares? If they want to jump down now and get into trouble, who objects? It'll be dark in 15 minutes, and then let them follow us if they want to. I'm willing. In my opinion, whoever hove those things in here caught a sight of us and took us for ghosts or devils or something. I'll bet they're running yet." Joe grumbled a while. Then he agreed with his friend that what daylight was left ought to be economized in getting things ready for leaving. Shortly afterward, they slipped out of the house in the deepening twilight and moved toward the river with their precious box. Tom and Huck rose up, weak but vastly relieved, and stared after them through the chinks between the logs of the house. Follow? Not they. They were content to reach ground again without broken necks and take the townward track over the hill. They did not talk much. They were too much absorbed in hating themselves, hating the ill luck that made them take the spade and the pick there. But for that, Injun Joe never would have suspected. He would have hidden the silver with the gold to wait there till his revenge was satisfied, and then he would have had the misfortune to find that money turn up missing. Bitter, bitter luck that the tools were ever brought there. They resolved to keep a lookout for that Spaniard when he should come to town, spying out for chances to do his revengeful job, and follow him to number 2, wherever that might be. Then a ghastly thought occurred to Tom.
Revenge? What if he means us, Huck?
Oh, don't,
said Huck, nearly fainting.
They talked it all over, and as they entered town, they agreed to believe that he might possibly mean somebody else. At least, that he might at least mean nobody but Tom, since only Tom had testified. Very, very small comfort it was to Tom to be alone in danger. Company would be a palpable improvement, he thought. Chapter 27. Trembling on the Trail. The adventure of the day mightily tormented Tom's dreams that night. 4 times he had his hands on that rich treasure, and 4 times it wasted to nothingness in his fingers as sleep forsook him and wakefulness brought back the hard reality of his misfortune. As he lay in the early morning, recalling the incidents of his great adventure, he noticed that they seemed curiously subdued and far away, somewhat as if they had happened in another world or in a time long gone by. Then it occurred to him that the great adventure itself must be a dream. There was one very strong argument in favor of this idea. namely, that a quantity of coin he had seen was too vast to be real. He had never seen as much as $50 in one mass before, and he was like all boys of his age and station in life, in that he imagined that all references to hundreds and thousands were mere fanciful forms of speech, and that no such sums really existed in the world. He never had supposed for a moment that so large a sum as $100 was to be found in actual money in anyone's possession. If his notions of hidden treasure had been analyzed, they would have been found to consist of a handful of real dimes and a bushel of vague, splendid, ungraspable dollars. But the incidents of his adventure grew sensibly sharper and clearer under the attrition of thinking them over, and so he presently found himself leaning to the impression that the thing might not have been a dream after all. This uncertainty must be swept away. He would snatch a hurried breakfast and go and find Huck. Huck was sitting on the gunwale of a flatboat, listlessly dangling his feet in the water and looking very melancholy. Tom concluded to let Huck lead up to the subject. If he did not do it, then the adventure would be proved to have been only a dream.
"Hello, Huck."
"Hello yourself."
Silence for a minute.
"Tom, if we'd have left the blamed tools at the dead tree, we'd have got the money. Oh, ain't it awful?"
"'Tain't a dream, then. 'Tain't a dream. Oh, somehow I most wish it was. Dogged if I don't, Huck."
"What ain't a dream?"
"Oh, that thing yesterday. I've been half thinking it was."
"Dream? If them stairs hadn't broke down, you'd have seen how much dream it was. I've had dreams enough, all right, with that patch-eyed Spanish devil going for me all through 'em. Rot him."
"No, not rot him. Find him. Track the money."
"Tom, we'll never find him. A feller don't have only one chance for such a pile, and that one's lost. I'd feel mighty shaky if I was to see him anyway."
"Well, so'd I.
But I'd like to see him anyway and track him out to his number two."
"Number two.
Yes, that's it. I've been thinking about that, but I can't make nothing out of it. What do you reckon it is?"
"I don't know.
It's too deep."
"Say, Huck, maybe it's the number of a house."
"Goody!"
"No, Tom, that ain't it. If it is, it ain't in this one horse town. They ain't no numbers here."
"Well, that's so. Let me think a minute. Here, it's the number of a room in a tavern, you know."
"Oh, that's the trick. There ain't only two taverns. We can find out quick.
You stay here, Huck, till I come."
Tom was off at once. He did not care to have Huck's company in public places. He was gone half an hour. He found that in the best tavern, number two had long been occupied by a young lawyer, and was still so occupied. In the less ostentatious house, number two was a mystery. The tavern keeper's young son said it was kept locked all the time, and he never saw anybody go into it or come out of it except at night. He did not know any particular reason for this state of things. Had had some little curiosity, but it was rather feeble. Had made the most of the mystery by entertaining himself with the idea that that room was haunted. Had noticed that there was a light in there the night before.
"That's what I found out, Huck. I reckon that's the very number two we're after."
"I reckon it is, Tom. Now what are you going to do?"
"Let me think."
Tom thought a long time. Then he said,
"I'll tell you. The back door of that number two is the door that comes out into that little close alley between the tavern and the old rattle-trap of a brick store. Now, you get hold of all the door keys you can find, and I'll nip all of Auntie's, and the first dark night we'll go there and try 'em. And mind you, keep a lookout for Injun Joe. because he said he was going to drop into town and spy around once more for a chance to get his revenge. If you see him, you just follow him. And if he don't go to that number two, that ain't the place.
Lordy, I don't want to follow him by myself. Why, it'll be night, sure. He might never see you. And if he did, maybe he'd never think anything.
Well, if it's pretty dark, I reckon I'll track him.
I don't know. I'll try.
You bet I'll follow him if it's dark, Huck. Why, he might have found out he couldn't get his revenge and be going right after that money.
It's so, Tom. It's so.
I'll follow him. I will, by jingles.
Now you're talking. Don't you ever weaken, Huck, and I won't.
Chapter 28. In the Lair of Injun Joe. That night, Tom and Huck were ready for their adventure. They hung about the neighborhood of the tavern until after 9, one watching the alley at a distance and the other the tavern door. Nobody entered the alley or left it. Nobody resembling the Spaniard entered or left the tavern door. The night promised to be a fair one, so Tom went home with the understanding that if a considerable degree of darkness came on, Huck was to come and meow, whereupon he would slip out and try the keys. But the night remained clear, and Huck closed his watch and retired to bed in an empty sugar hogshead about 12. Tuesday, the boys had the same ill luck. Also Wednesday, but Thursday night promised better. Tom slipped out in good season with his aunt's old tin lantern and a large towel to blindfold it with. He hid the lantern in Huck's sugar hogshead, and the watch began. An hour before midnight, the tavern closed up, and its lights, the only ones thereabouts, were put out. No Spaniard had been seen. Nobody had entered or left the alley. Everything was auspicious. The blackness of darkness reigned. The perfect stillness was interrupted only by occasional mutterings of distant thunder. Tom got his lantern, lit it in a hogshead, wrapped it closely in the towel, and the two adventurers crept in the gloom toward the tavern. Huck stood sentry, and Tom felt his way into the alley. Then there was a season of waiting anxiety that weighed upon Huck's spirits like a mountain. He began to wish he could see a flash from the lantern. It would frighten him, but it would at least tell him that Tom was alive yet. It seemed hours since Tom had disappeared. Surely he must have fainted. Maybe he was dead. Maybe his heart had burst under terror and excitement. In his uneasiness, Huck found himself drawing closer and closer to the alley, fearing all sorts of dreadful things and momentarily expecting some catastrophe to happen that would take away his breath. There was not much to take away, for he seemed only able to inhale it by thimblefuls, and his heart would soon wear itself out the way it was beating. Suddenly, there was a flash of light, and Tom came tearing by him.
"Run," said he. "Run for your life."
He needn't have repeated it. Once was enough. Huck was making 30 or 40 miles an hour before the repetition was uttered. The boys never stopped till they reached the shed of a deserted slaughterhouse at the lower end of the village. Just as they got within its shelter, the storm burst and the rain poured down. As soon as Tom got his breath, he said,
"Huck, it was awful. I tried two of the keys just as soft as I could, but they seemed to make such a power of racket that I couldn't hardly get my breath. I was so scared. They wouldn't turn in the lock either. Well, without noticing what I was doing, I took hold of the knob, and open comes the door. It weren't locked. I hopped in and shook off the towel, and great Caesar's ghost. What'd you see, Tom? Huck, I most stepped on the Injun Joe's hand.
No.
Yes. He was laying there, sound asleep on the floor with his old patch on his eye and his arms spread out.
Lordy, what'd you do? Did he wake up?
No, never budged. drunk, I reckon. I just grabbed that towel and started. I'd never have thought of the towel, I bet. Well, I would. My aunt would make me mighty sick if I lost it. Say, Tom, did you see that box? Huck, I didn't wait to look around. I didn't see the box. I didn't see the cross. I didn't see anything but a bottle and a tin cup on the floor by Injun Joe. Yes, and I saw two barrels and lots more bottles in the room. Don't you see now what's the matter with that haunted room? How? Why, it's haunted with whiskey. Maybe all the temperance taverns have got a haunted room. Hey, Huck? Well, I reckon maybe that's so. Who'd have thought such a thing? But say, Tom, now's a mighty good time to get that box, if Injun Joe's drunk. It is that. You try it.
Huck shuddered.
Well, no, I reckon not. And I reckon not, Huck. Only one bottle alongside Injun Joe ain't enough. If there'd been three, he'd be drunk enough and I'd do it.
There was a long pause for reflection, and then Tom said,
Looky here, Huck. Let's not try that thing any more till we know Injun Joe's not in there. It's too scary. Now, if we watch every night, we'll be dead sure to see him go out sometime or other, and then we'll snatch that box quicker than lightning.
Well, I'm agreed. I'll watch the whole night long, and I'll do it every night, too, if you'll do the other part of the job.
All right, I will. All you got to do is trot up Hooper Street a block and meow, and if I'm asleep, you throw some gravel at the window, and that'll fetch me.
Agreed and good as wheat.
Now, Huck, the storm's over, and I'll go home. It'll begin to be daylight in a couple of hours. You go back and watch that long, will you?
I said I would, Tom, and I will. I'll haunt that tavern every night for a year. I'll sleep all day, and I'll stay and watch all night.
That's all right. Now, where are you going to sleep?
In Ben Rogers' hayloft. He lets me, and so does his pap's nigger man, Uncle Jake. I tote water for Uncle Jake whenever he wants me to, and any time I ask him, he gives me a little something to eat, if he can spare it.
That's a mighty good nigger, Tom. He likes me, because I don't ever act as if I was above him. Sometimes, I'll sit right down and eat with him.
But you needn't tell that. A body's got to do things when he's awful hungry he wouldn't want to do as a steady thing.
Well, if I don't want you in the daytime, I'll let you sleep. I won't come bothering around. Anytime you see something's up in the night, just skip right around and meow.
Chapter 29. Huck Saves the Widow. The first thing Tom heard on Friday morning was a glad piece of news. Judge Thatcher's family had come back to town the night before. Both Injun Joe and the treasure sank into secondary importance for a moment, and Becky took the chief place in the boy's interest. He saw her, and they had an exhausting good time playing high spy and gully keeper with a crowd of their schoolmates. The day was completed and crowned in a peculiarly satisfactory way. Becky teased her mother to appoint the next day for the long-promised and long-delayed picnic, and she consented. The child's delight was boundless, and Tom's not more moderate. The invitations were sent out before sunset, and straightway the young folks of the village were thrown into a fever of preparation and pleasurable anticipation. Tom's excitement enabled him to keep awake until a pretty late hour, and he had good hopes of hearing Huck's meow and of having his treasure to astonish Becky and the picnickers with next day. But he was disappointed. No signal came that night. Morning came, eventually, and by 10 or 11 o'clock a giddy and rollicking company were gathered at Judge Thatcher's, and everything was ready for a start. It was not the custom for elderly people to mar picnics with their presence. The children were considered safe enough under the wings of a few young ladies of 18 and a few young gentlemen of 23 or thereabouts. The old steam ferry boat was chartered for the occasion. Presently,
the gay throng filed up the main street, laden with provision baskets. Sid was sick and had to miss the fun. Mary remained at home to entertain him. The last thing Mrs. Thatcher said to Becky was, "You'll not get back till late. Perhaps you'd better stay all night with some of the girls that live near the ferry landing, child." "Then I'll stay with Susie Harper, Mama." "Very well. And mind and behave yourself, and don't be any trouble." Presently, as they tripped along, Tom said to Becky,
"Say, I'll tell you what we'll do. Instead of going to Joe Harper's, we'll climb right up the hill and stop at the Widow Douglas's. She'll have ice cream. She has it most every day, dead loads of it, and she'll be awful glad to have us."
"Oh, that will be fun." Then Becky reflected a moment and said, "But what will Mama say?"
"How'll she ever know?"
The girl turned the idea over in her mind and said reluctantly,
"I reckon it's wrong, but..."
"But shucks, your mother won't know, and so what's the harm? All she wants is that you'll be safe, and I'll bet you she'd have said go there if she'd have thought of it. I know she would."
The Widow Douglas's splendid hospitality was a tempting bait. It and Tom's persuasions presently carried the day. So it was decided to say nothing to anybody about the night's program. Presently it occurred to Tom that maybe Huck might come this very night and give the signal. The thought took a deal of the spirit out of his anticipations. Still, he could not bear to give up the fun at Widow Douglas's. And why should he give it up, he reasoned? The signal did not come the night before, so why should it be any more likely to come tonight? The sure fun of the evening outweighed the uncertain treasure, and, boy-like, he determined to yield to the stronger inclination and not allow himself to think of the box of money another time that day. 3 miles below town, the ferry boat stopped at the mouth of a woody hollow and tied up. The crowd swarmed ashore, and soon the forest distances and craggy heights echoed far and near with shoutings and laughter. All the different ways of getting hot and tired were gone through with, and by the rovers straggled back to camp, fortified with responsible appetites. And then the destruction of the good things began. After the feast, there was a refreshing season of rest and chat in the shade of spreading oaks. By and by, somebody shouted,
"Who's ready for the cave?"
Everybody was. Bundles of candles were procured, and straightway there was a general scamper up the hill. The mouth of the cave was up the hillside, an opening shaped like a letter A. Its massive oaken door stood unbarred. Within was a small chamber, chilly as an ice house, and walled by nature with solid limestone that was dewy with a cold sweat. It was romantic and mysterious to stand here in the deep gloom and look out upon the green valley shining in the sun. But the impressiveness of the situation quickly wore off, and the romping began again. The moment a candle was lighted, there was a general rush upon the owner of it. A struggle and a gallant defense followed, but the candle was soon knocked down or blown out, and then there was a glad clamor of laughter and a new chase. But all things have an end. By and by, the procession went filing down the steep descent of the main avenue, the flickering rank of lights dimly revealing the lofty walls of rock almost to their point of junction, 60 feet overhead. This main avenue was not more than 8 or 10 feet wide. Every few steps, other lofty and still narrower crevices branched from it on either hand, for MacDougall's cave was but a vast labyrinth of crooked aisles that ran into each other and out again and led nowhere. It was said that one might wander days and nights together through its intricate tangle of rifts and chasms and never find the end of the cave,
and that he might go down and down and still down into the earth, and it was just the same, labyrinth underneath labyrinth, and no end to any of them. No man knew the cave. That was an impossible thing. Most of the young men knew a portion of it, and it was not customary to venture much beyond this known portion. Tom Sawyer knew as much of the cave as anyone. The procession moved along the main avenue some 3/4 of a mile, and then groups and couples began to slip aside into branch avenues, fly along the dismal corridors, and take each other by surprise at points where the corridors joined again. Parties were able to elude each other for the space of 30 minutes without going beyond the known ground. By and by, one group after another came straggling back to the mouth of the cave, panting, hilarious, smeared from head to foot with tallow drippings, daubed with clay, and entirely delighted with the success of the day. Then they were astonished to find that they had been taking no note of time and that night was about at hand. The clanging bell had been calling for 30 minutes. However, this sort of close to the day's adventures was romantic and therefore satisfactory. When the ferry boat with her wild freight pushed into the stream, nobody cared 6 pence for the wasted time but the captain of the craft. Huck was already upon his watch when the ferry boat's lights went glinting past the wharf. He heard no noise on board, for the young people were as subdued and still as people usually are who are nearly tired to death. He wondered what boat it was, and why she did not stop at the wharf, and then he dropped her out of his mind and put his attention upon his business. The night was growing cloudy and dark. 10 o'clock came, and the noise of vehicles ceased. Scattered lights began to wink out, all straggling foot passengers disappeared. The village betook itself to its slumbers and left the small watcher alone with the silence and the ghosts. 11 o'clock came, and the tavern lights were put out. Darkness everywhere now. Huck waited what seemed a weary long time, but nothing happened. His faith was weakening. Was there any use? Was there really any use? Why not give it up and turn in? A noise fell upon his ear. He was all attention in an instant. The alley door closed softly. He sprang to the corner of the brick store. The next moment, 2 men brushed by him, and one seemed to have something under his arm. It must be that box. So they were going to remove the treasure. Why call Tom now? It would be absurd. The men would get away with the box and never be found again. No, he would stick to their wake and follow them. He would trust to the darkness for security from discovery. So communing with himself, Huck stepped out and glided along behind the men, cat-like, with bare feet, allowing them to keep just far enough ahead not to be invisible. They moved up the river street 3 blocks, then turned to the left, up a cross street. They went straight ahead then until they came to the path that led up Cardiff Hill. This they took. They passed by the old Welshman's house halfway up the hill without hesitating and still climbed upward. Good, thought Huck. They'll bury it in the old quarry. But they never stopped at the quarry. They passed on, up the summit. They plunged into the narrow path between the tall sumac bushes and were at once hidden in the gloom. Huck closed up and shortened his distance now, for they would never be able to see him. He trotted along a while, then slackened his pace, fearing he was gaining too fast. Moved on a piece, then stopped altogether. Listened. No sound. None. Save that he seemed to hear the beating of his own heart. The hooting of an owl came from over the hill. Ominous sound.
but no footsteps. Heavens, was everything lost? He was about to spring with winged feet when a man cleared his throat not 4 feet from him. Huck's heart shot into his throat, but he swallowed it again, and then he stood there shaking as if a dozen agues had taken charge of him at once, and so weak that he thought he must surely fall to the ground. He knew where he was. He knew he was within 5 steps of the stile leading into Widow Douglas's grounds. Very well, he thought. Let them bury it there. It won't be hard to find. Now there was a voice, a very low voice, Injun Joe's.
Damn her. Maybe she's got company. There's lights late as it is.
I can't see any.
This was that stranger's voice, the stranger of the haunted house. A deadly chill went to Huck's heart. This, then, was the revenge job. His thought was to fly. Then he remembered that the Widow Douglas had been kind to him more than once, and maybe these men were going to murder her. He wished he dared venture to warn her, but he knew he didn't dare. They might come and catch him. He thought all this and more in the moment that elapsed between the stranger's remark and Injun Joe's next, which was,
"Because the bush is in your way. Now, this way, now you see, don't you?"
"Yes. Well, there is company there, I reckon.
Better give it up." "Give it up, and I'd just leave in this country forever? Give it up and maybe never have another chance? I tell you again, as I've told you before, I don't care for her swag. You may have it, but her husband was rough on me. Many times he was rough on me, and mainly he was the justice of the peace that jugged me for a vagrant. And that ain't all. It ain't a millionth part of it. He had me horsewhipped. Horsewhipped in front of the jail like a nigger, with all the town looking on. Horsewhipped! Do you understand? He took advantage of me and died. But I'll take it out of her."
"Oh, don't kill her. Don't do that."
"Kill? Who said anything about killing? I would kill him if he was here. But not her. When you want to get revenge on a woman, you don't kill her. Bosh. You go for her looks. You slit her nostrils, you notch her ears like a sow. By God, keep your opinion to yourself. It'll be safest for you. I'll tie her to the bed. If she bleeds to death, is that my fault? I'll not cry if she does. My friend, you'll help in this thing. For my sake, that's why you're here. I mightn't be able alone. If you flinch, I'll kill you. Do you understand that? And if I have to kill you, I'll kill her. And then I reckon nobody'll ever know much about who done this business."
"Well, if it's got to be done, let's get at it. The quicker the better. I'm all in a shiver."
"Do it now? And company that, look here. I'll get suspicious of you first thing you know. No, we'll wait till the lights are out. There's no hurry."
Huck felt that a silence was going to ensue, a thing still more awful than any amount of murderous talk, so he held his breath and stepped gingerly back, planted his foot carefully and firmly, after balancing one-legged in a precarious way and almost toppling over, first on one side and then on the other. He took another step back, with the same elaboration and the same risks. Then another, and another, and a twig snapped under his foot. His breath stopped, and he listened. There was no sound. The stillness was perfect. His gratitude was measureless. Now he turned in his tracks between the walls of sumac bushes, turned himself as carefully as if he were a ship, and then stepped quickly but cautiously along. When he emerged at the quarry, he felt secure, and so he picked up his nimble heels and flew. Down, down he sped till he reached the Welshman's. He banged at the door, and presently the heads of the old man and his two stalwart sons were thrust from windows.
"What's the row there? Who's banging? What do you want?"
"Let me in. Quick, I'll tell everything."
Who are you?"
"Huckleberry Finn. Quick, let me in."
"Huckleberry Finn, indeed. It ain't a name to open many doors, I judge. But let him in, lads, and let's see what's the trouble."
"Please don't ever tell I told you,"
were Huck's first words when he got in.
"Please don't. I'd be killed, sure. But the widow's been good friends to me sometimes, and I want to tell. I will tell, if you'll promise you won't ever say it was me."
"By George, he has got something to tell, or he wouldn't act so,"
exclaimed the old man.
"Out with it, and nobody here will ever tell, lad."
3 minutes later, the old man and his sons, well armed, were up the hill, and just entering the sumac path on tiptoe, their weapons in their hands. Huck accompanied them no farther. He hid behind a great boulder and fell to listening. There was a lagging, anxious silence, and then, all of a sudden, there was an explosion of firearms and a cry. Huck waited for no particulars. He sprang away and sped down the hill as fast as his legs could carry him. Chapter 30. Tom and Becky in the Cave. As the earliest suspicion of dawn appeared on Sunday morning, Huck came groping up the hill and rapped gently at the old Welshman's door. The inmates were asleep, but it was a sleep that was set on a hair trigger, on account of the exciting episode of the night. A call came from a window.
"Who's there?"
Huck's scared voice answered in a low tone.
"Please, let me in. It's only Huck Finn."
"It's a name that can open this door night or day, lad. And welcome."
These were strange words to the vagabond boy's ears, and the pleasantest he had ever heard. He could not recollect that the closing word had ever been applied in his case before. The door was quickly unlocked, and he entered. Huck was given a seat, and the old man and his brace of tall sons speedily dressed themselves.
"Now, my boy, I hope you're good and hungry, because breakfast will be ready as soon as the sun's up, and we'll have a piping hot one, too. Make yourself easy about that. I and the boys hoped you'd turn up and stop here last night."
"I was awful scared," said Huck, "and I run. I took out when the pistols went off, and I didn't stop for 3 mile. I come now because I wanted to know about it, you know. And I come before daylight because I didn't want to run across them devils, even if they was dead."
"Well, poor chap, you do look as if you'd had a hard night of it. But there's a bed here for you when you've had your breakfast." "No, they ain't dead, lad. We are sorry enough for that. You see, we knew right where to put our hands on them by your description, so we crept along on tiptoe till we got within 15 feet of them. Dark as a cellar, that sumac path was. And just then, I found I was going to sneeze. It was the meanest kind of luck. I tried to keep it back, but no use. 'Twas bound to come, and it did come. I was in the lead with my pistol raised, and when the sneeze started, those scoundrels are rustling to get out of the path. I sung out, 'Fire, boys!' and blazed away at the place where the rustling was. So did the boys, but they were off in a jiffy, those villains, and we were after them, down through the woods. I judge we never touched them. They fired a shot of peace as they started, but their bullets whizzed by and didn't do us any harm. As soon as we lost the sound of their feet, we quit chasing and went down and stirred up the constables. They got a posse together and went off to guard the river bank, and as soon as it is light, the sheriff and a gang are going to beat up the woods. My boys will be with them presently. I wish we had some sort of description of those rascals. 'Twould help a good deal. But you couldn't see what they were like in the dark, lad, I suppose."
"Oh, yes, I saw them downtown and followed them."
"Splendid! Describe 'em. Describe 'em, my boy."
One's the old deaf and dumb Spaniard that's been around here once or twice, and t'other's a mean-looking ragged...
That's enough, lad. We know the men. Happened on them in the woods back of the widow's one day, and they slunk away. Off with you, boys, and tell the sheriff. Get your breakfast tomorrow morning.
The Welshman's sons departed at once. As they were leaving the room, Huck sprang up and exclaimed,
Oh, please don't tell anybody it was me that blowed on them. Oh, please.
All right, if you say it, Huck. But you ought to have the credit of what you did.
Oh, no, no, please don't tell.
When the young men were gone, the old Welshman said,
Well, they won't tell, and I won't. But why don't you want it known?
Huck would not explain further than to say that he already knew too much about one of those men and would not have the man know that he knew anything against him for the whole world. He would be killed for knowing it, sure. The old man promised secrecy once more and said,
How did you come to follow these fellows, lad? Were they looking suspicious?
Huck was silent while he framed a duly cautious reply. Then he said,
Well, you see, I'm a kind of a hard lot. Least everybody says so. And I don't see nothing agin it. And sometimes I can't sleep much on account of thinking about it and sort of trying to strike out a new way of doing. That was the way of it last night. I couldn't sleep, and so I come along up street about midnight, turning it all over. And when I got to that old shackly brick store by the Temperance Tavern, I backed up agin the wall to have another think. Well, just then, along comes these two chaps slipping along close by me with something under their arm, and I reckoned they'd stole it. One was a-smoking, and t'other one wanted a light, so they stopped right before me, and the cigars lit up their faces, and I see that the big one was the deaf and dumb Spaniard by his white whiskers and the patch on his eye, and t'other one was a rusty, ragged-looking devil.
Could you see the rags by the light of the cigars?
This staggered Huck for a moment. Then he said,
Well, I don't know, but... Somehow it seems as if I did.
Then they went on and you...
Followed them, yes. That was it. I wanted to see what was up. They sneaked along so. I dogged them to the widder stile and stood in the dark and heard the ragged one beg for the widder. And the Spaniard swear he'd spile her looks just as I told you and your two...
What? The deaf and dumb man said all that?
Huck had made another terrible mistake. He was trying his best to keep the old man from getting the faintest hint of who the Spaniard might be, and yet his tongue seemed determined to get him into trouble in spite of all he could do. He made several efforts to creep out of his scrape, but the old man's eye was upon him, and he made blunder after blunder. Presently, the Welshman said,
My boy... Don't be afraid of me. I wouldn't hurt a hair of your head for all the world. No, I'd protect you. I'd protect you. This Spaniard is not deaf and dumb. You've let that slip without intending it. You can't cover that up now. You know something about that Spaniard that you want to keep dark. Now, trust me. Tell me what it is and trust me. I won't betray you.
Huck looked into the old man's honest eyes a moment, then bent over and whispered in his ear,
"'Tain't a Spaniard. It's Injun Joe."
The Welshman almost jumped out of his chair. In a moment he said,
"'It's all plain enough. Now, when you talked about notching ears and slitting noses, I judged that that was your own embellishment, because white men don't take that sort of revenge, but an Injun—' That's a different matter altogether.
During breakfast, the talk went on, and in the course of it, the old man said that the last thing which he and his sons had done before going to bed was to get a lantern and examine the stile and its vicinity for marks of blood. They found none, but captured a bulky bundle of...
Of what?
If the words had been lightning, they could not have leaped with a more stunning suddenness from Huck's blanched lips. His eyes were staring wide now, and his breath suspended, waiting for the answer. The Welshman started,
stared in return. 3 seconds. 5 seconds. 10. Then replied,
"A burglar's tools. Well, what's the matter with you?"
Huck sank back, panting gently but deeply, unutterably grateful. The Welshman eyed him gravely, curiously, and presently said,
"Yes, burglar's tools. That appears to relieve you a good deal. But what did give you that turn? What were you expecting we'd found?"
Huck was in a close place. The inquiring eye was upon him. He would have given anything for material for a plausible answer. Nothing suggested itself. The inquiring eye was boring deeper and deeper. A senseless reply offered. There was no time to weigh it, so at a venture he uttered it, feebly.
"Sunday school books, maybe?"
Poor Huck was too distressed to smile, but the old man laughed loud and joyously, shook up the details of his anatomy from head to foot, and ended by saying that such a laugh was money in a man's pocket because it cut down the doctor's bills like everything. Then he added,
"Poor old chap, you're white and jaded. You ain't well a bit. No wonder you're a little flighty and off your balance." "I bet you'll come out of it. Rest and sleep will fit you out all right, I hope."
Huck was irritated to think he had been such a goose and betrayed such a suspicious excitement, for he had dropped the idea that the parcel brought from the tavern was the treasure as soon as he had heard the talk at the widow's stile. He had only thought it was not the treasure, however. He had not known that it wasn't, and so the suggestion of a captured bundle was too much for his self-possession. But on the whole, he felt glad the little episode had happened, for now he knew beyond all question that that bundle was not the bundle, and so his mind was at rest and exceedingly comfortable. In fact, everything seemed to be drifting just in the right direction now. The treasure must be still in number 2. The man would be captured and jailed that day, and he and Tom could seize the gold that night without any trouble or any fear of interruption. Just as breakfast was completed, there was a knock at the door. Huck jumped for a hiding place, for he had no mind to be connected even remotely with the late event. The Welshman admitted several ladies and gentlemen, among them the Widow Douglas, and noticed that groups of citizens were climbing up the hill to stare at the stile. So the news had spread. The Welshman had to tell the story of the night to the visitors. The widow's gratitude for her preservation was outspoken.
"Oh, don't say a word about it, madam. There's another that you're more beholden to than you are to me and my boys, maybe, but he don't allow me to tell his name. We wouldn't have been there but for him."
Of course, this excited a curiosity so vast that it almost belittled the main matter. But the Welshman allowed it to eat into the vitals of his visitors, and through them be transmitted to the whole town, for he refused to part with his secret. When all else had been learned, the widow said,
"I went to sleep reading in bed and slept straight through all that noise. Why didn't you come and wake me?"
"Well, we judged it weren't worthwhile. Those fellas weren't likely to come again. They hadn't any tools left to work with, and what was the use of waking you up and scaring you to death? My 3 Negro men stood guard at your house all the rest of the night. They've just come back."
More visitors came, and the story had to be told and retold for a couple of hours more. There was no Sabbath school during day school vacation, but everybody was early at church. The stirring event was well canvassed. News came that not a sign of the 2 villains had been yet discovered. When the sermon was finished, Judge Thatcher's wife dropped alongside of Mrs. Harper as she moved down the aisle with the crowd and said,
"Is my Becky going to sleep all day? I just expected she would be tired to death."
"Your Becky?"
"Yes,"
with a startled look.
Didn't she stay with you last night? Why, no.
Mrs. Thatcher turned pale and sank into a pew, just as Aunt Polly, talking briskly with a friend, passed by. Aunt Polly said,
"Good morning, Mrs. Thatcher.
Good morning, Mrs. Harper. I've got a boy that's turned up missing. I reckon my Tom stayed at your house last night, one of you, and now he's afraid to come to church. I've got to settle with him."
Mrs. Thatcher shook her head feebly and turned paler than ever.
"He didn't stay with us," said Mrs. Harper, beginning to look uneasy.
A marked anxiety came into Aunt Polly's face.
"Joe Harper, have you seen my Tom this morning?"
"No'm."
"When did you see him last?"
Joe tried to remember, but was not sure he could say. The people had stopped moving out of church. Whispers passed along, and a boding uneasiness took possession of every countenance. Children were anxiously questioned, and young teachers. They all said they had not noticed whether Tom and Becky were on board the ferryboat on the homeward trip. It was dark. No one thought of inquiring if anyone was missing. One young man finally blurted out his fear that they were still in the cave. Mrs. Thatcher swooned away. Aunt Polly fell to crying and wringing her hands. The alarm swept from lip to lip, from group to group, from street to street, and within 5 minutes the bells were wildly clanging, and the whole town was up. The Cardiff Hill episode sank into instant insignificance. The burglars were forgotten, horses were saddled, skiffs were manned, the ferryboat ordered out, and before the horror was half an hour old, 200 men were pouring down high road and river toward the cave. All the long afternoon the village seemed empty and dead. Many women visited Aunt Polly and Mrs. Thatcher and tried to comfort them. They cried with them, too, and that was still better than words. All the tedious night the town waited for news, but when the morning dawned at last, all the word that came was, "Send more candles and send food." Mrs. Thatcher was almost crazed, and Aunt Polly also. Judge Thatcher sent messages of hope and encouragement from the cave, but they conveyed no real cheer. The old Welshman came home toward daylight, spattered with candle grease, smeared with clay, and almost worn out. He found Huck still in the bed that had been provided for him, and delirious with fever. The physicians were all at the cave, so the Widow Douglas came and took charge of the patient. She said she would do her best by him because, whether he was good, bad, or indifferent, he was the Lord's, and nothing that was the Lord's was a thing to be neglected. The Welshman said Huck had good spots in him, and the widow said,
"You can depend on it. That's the Lord's mark. He don't leave it off. He never does. Puts it somewhere on every creature that comes from his hands."
Early in the forenoon, parties of jaded men began to straggle into the village, but the strongest of the citizens continued searching. All the news that could be gained was that remotenesses of the cavern were being ransacked that had never been visited before, that every corner and crevice was going to be thoroughly searched, that wherever one wandered through the maze of passages, lights were to be seen flitting hither and thither in the distance, and shoutings and pistol shots sent their hollow reverberations to the ear down the somber aisles. In one place, far from the section usually traversed by tourists, the names Becky and Tom had been found, traced upon the rocky wall with candle smoke, and near at hand, a grease-soiled bit of ribbon. Mrs. Thatcher recognized the ribbon and cried over it. She said it was the last relic she should ever have of her child, and that no other memorial of her could ever be so precious, because this one parted latest from the living body before the awful death came. Some said that now and then in the cave a faraway speck of light would glimmer, and then a glorious shout would burst forth, and a score of men go trooping down the echoing aisle, and then a sickening disappointment always followed. The children were not there. It was only a searcher's light. 3 dreadful days and nights dragged their tedious hours along, and the village sank into a hopeless stupor. No one had heart for anything. The accidental discovery just made that the proprietor of the Temperance Tavern kept liquor on his premises scarcely fluttered the public pulse, tremendous as the fact was. In a lucid interval, Huck feebly led up to the subject of taverns and finally asked, dimly dreading the worst, if anything had been discovered at the Temperance Tavern since he had been ill.
"Yes," said the widow.
Huck started up in bed, wild-eyed.
"What? What was it?"
"Liquor. And the place has been shut up. Lie down, child. What a turn you did give me. Only tell me just one thing. Only just one, please. Was it Tom Sawyer that found it?"
The widow burst into tears.
"Hush! Hush, child, hush. I've told you before, you must not talk. You are very, very sick."
Then nothing but liquor had been found. There would have been a great powwow if it had been the gold. So the treasure was gone forever. Gone forever. But what could she be crying about? Curious that she should cry. These thoughts worked their dim way through Huck's mind, and under the weariness they gave him, he fell asleep. The widow said to herself,
"There, he's asleep, poor wreck. Tom Sawyer find it. Pity but somebody could find Tom Sawyer. There ain't many left now that's got hope enough, or strength enough either, to go on searching."
Chapter 31. Found and Lost Again. Now to return to Tom and Becky's share in the picnic. They tripped along the murky aisles with the rest of the company, visiting the familiar wonders of the cave, wonders dubbed with rather over-descriptive names such as the Drawing Room, the Cathedral, Aladdin's Palace, and so on. Presently, the hide-and-seek frolicking began, and Tom and Becky engaged in it with zeal until the exertion began to grow a trifle wearisome. Then they wandered down a sinuous avenue, holding their candles aloft and reading the tangled webwork of names, dates, post office addresses, and mottos with which the rocky walls had been frescoed in candle smoke. Still drifting along and talking, they scarcely noticed that they were now in a part of the cave whose walls were not frescoed. They smoked their own names under an overhanging shelf and moved on. Presently, they came to a place where a little stream of water, trickling over a ledge and carrying a limestone sediment with it, had, in the slow-dragging ages, formed a laced and ruffled Niagara in gleaming and imperishable stone. Tom squeezed his small body behind it in order to illuminate it for Becky's gratification. He found that it curtained a sort of steep, natural stairway which was enclosed between narrow walls, and at once the ambition to be a discoverer seized him. Becky responded to his call, and they made a smoke mark for future guidance and started upon their quest. They wound this way and that, far down into the secret depths of the cave, made another mark, and branched off in search of novelties to tell the upper world about. In one place they found a spacious cavern, from whose ceiling depended a multitude of shining stalactites of the length and circumference of a man's leg.
They walked all about it, wondering and admiring, and presently left it by one of the numerous passages that opened into it. This shortly brought them to a bewitching spring, whose basin was encrusted with a frostwork of glittering crystals. It was in the midst of a cavern, whose walls were supported by many fantastic pillars, which had been formed by the joining of great stalactites and stalagmites together, the result of the ceaseless water drip of centuries. Under the roof, vast knots of bats had packed themselves together, thousands in a bunch. The lights disturbed the creatures, and they came flocking down by hundreds, squeaking and darting furiously at the candles. Tom knew their ways and the danger of this sort of conduct. He seized Becky's hand and hurried her into the first corridor that offered, and none too soon, for a bat struck Becky's light out with its wing while she was passing out of the cavern. The bats chased the children a good distance, but the fugitives plunged into every new passage that offered, and at last got rid of the perilous things. Tom found a subterranean lake shortly, which stretched its dim length away until its shape was lost in the shadows. He wanted to explore its borders, but concluded that it would be best to sit down and rest a while first. Now, for the first time, the deep stillness of the place laid a clammy hand upon the spirits of the children. Becky said,
"Why, I didn't notice, but it seems ever so long since I heard of any of the others."
"Come to think of it, Becky, we are away down below them, and I don't know how far away north or south, or east, or whichever it is. We couldn't hear them here."
Becky grew apprehensive.
"I wonder how long we've been down here, Tom. We better start back."
"Yes, I reckon we better. Perhaps we better."
"Can you find the way, Tom? It's all a mixed-up crookedness to me."
"I reckon I could find it. But then, the bats. If they put both our candles out, it'll be an awful fix. Let's try some other way, so as not to go through there."
"Well, but I hope we won't get lost. It would be so awful."
And the girl shuddered at the thought of the dreadful possibilities. They started through a corridor and traversed it in silence a long way, glancing at each new opening to see if there was anything familiar about the look of it. But they were all strange. Every time Tom made an examination, Becky would watch his face for an encouraging sign, and he would say cheerily,
"Oh, it's all right. This ain't the one, but we'll come to it right away."
But he felt less and less hopeful with each failure, and presently began to turn off into diverging avenues at sheer random, in desperate hope of finding the one that was wanted. He still said it was all right, but there was such a leaden dread at his heart that the words had lost their ring and sounded just as if he had said, "All is lost." Becky clung to his side in an anguish of fear and tried hard to keep back the tears, but they would come. At last she said,
"Oh, Tom, never mind the bats. Let's go back that way. We seem to get worse and worse off all the time."
Tom stopped.
"Listen,"
said he. Profound silence. Silence so deep that even their breathings were conspicuous in the hush. Tom shouted. The call went echoing down the empty aisles and died out in the distance in a faint sound that resembled a ripple of mocking laughter.
"Oh, don't do it again, Tom. It is too horrid,"
said Becky.
"It is horrid, but I better, Becky.
They might hear us, you know.
And he shouted again. The might was even a chillier horror than the ghostly laughter. It so confessed a perishing hope. The children stood still and listened, but there was no result. Tom turned upon the back track at once and hurried his steps. It was but a little while before a certain indecision in his manner revealed another fearful fact to Becky. He could not find his way back.
Oh, Tom, you didn't make any marks. Becky, I was such a fool. Such a fool. I never thought we might want to come back. No, I can't find the way. It's all mixed up. Tom, we're lost. We're lost. We never can get out of this awful place. Why did we ever leave the others?
This is the end of disc number 7. Please insert disc number 8.